This tape is property of Custer County Library. It is part of the historical taping series.
Tape at the community building in Westcliff in April 1967. Present are Mrs. Arlie Riggs interviewing Mr. A.D. Hess of Westcliff.
Yeah, we're ready to go?
We're ready to go.
That's quite an assignment, but my name first.
Right.
Well, I was christened Archie D. Hess, but I've had a bunch of names. I'm known as Grandpa, Dad, Pappy, and Hey You, and my Indian name, I spent several years with the Sioux in Dakota, is Waitotlishunkakow, which in Sioux means wild horse, from the fact that, I became the blood brother of Spotted Tail, and of course I'm legally a Sioux, and we were always on wild horses, thought we were bronc twisters, you know, so they gave me that name of Waitotlishunkakow, which means wild horse.
How old are you, Mr. Hess?
Well, I have seen 80 birthdays, counting my first one. Of course, I'm not quite 80 years old because I'll have 81 birthdays before I'm 80.
Oh, you confuse me. My dad used to do that to me.
Huh? I say answer. You
haven't
answer yes or no.
Can you hear Ma Raven?
Oh, sure. We're going to leave Ma on there, too. Just let her keep talking,
see,
right?
Hi, Taylor. Getting out of the way. What else was it?
How long have you been here in Custer County?
About 51 years.
Okay. Now, I wanted Mr. Hess especially...
Pappy.
Okay. A.D. I call him lots of things, too, but usually A.D. But I wanted him to tell us especially about the Rainbow Trail, because I have found from trying to do a little research on forestry that no one really knows much about the laying out and the planting of a trail and so forth. So A.D. has notes here, and he's going to tell us all he knows, right?
Well, some of it I don't tell anybody, of course. But I started on trail work on the San Isidro National Forest in 1925. Steve Doering was the district ranger at the time, and Fritz Polk was the forest supervisor. And the first work I ever did on the trail was near the Alvarado Ranger Station on August 8, 1925. Now, we're sure about these dates because I have a diary now, which is about 56 years old without a day missing, so all these dates that I happen to mention will be authentic. And my first work was done with William Bill Falkenberg, who was an uncle of our present Bill Falkenberg, and one of the most wonderful lovers of nature's and nature gentlemen that I ever knew. He was good at his work in the forest, and he made pets of any animal that he would find, from a porcupine to a pack rat, and was a good man around the camp and a good buddy to be with. Of course, Bill has been gone now for several years, and the sad part of it is that he got to be pretty old. He's still a pretty good man, but I went on the trail without him, and that year Bill passed away. He died. He just couldn't take it. And he could have made it all right, but the service figured he was too old to work, and it really killed Bill. My notes here. Says that Bill took the horses, old Lige and Queen, out to the ranger station in the morning, and I drove out about 1 p.m. and we came up to Venable Lake's cabin. Bill caught 4 trout and I one from the lakes. The next day we spent repairing the cabins. It was on Monday. We kept the horses up there, picketed Queen out, and old Lige, he wouldn't leave camp at all. He was a camp horse. Then we went to work on repairing the trail down from the top of the range above the lakes. We saw a bunch of ptarmigan and some mountain sheep. And in the evening, we drove down to the ranger station and came home.
Oh.
Now,
go ahead.
On Monday, August 17th, Josie and I came up to the Venable Lakes camp and finished out the day on the trail. We were pretty honest in them days. If we went to camp and didn't get to work, why, we just kept track of the hours we worked, and that was it. Lige had cut his foot. That is a large pack horse. And the wire, so we packed mostly on Queen and hiked up the trail. Bill had saved us a nice bunch of trout, which he caught on Sunday. On Tuesday, Josie caught 7 trout in the lake, the first trout she ever caught, and has been catching them regularly ever since. Bill went down the trail at the place we use when going home in the afternoon, and Josie caught some more trout from the lakes. And on Friday, August 21st, again, she caught some more trout, and Bill got back to camp. And Josie and I hiked on down the trail and came home. Archie, on Sunday, 23-19-25, came up to camp. In the afternoon, he landed a job with us.
Archie is your son?
Yeah, my oldest boy, okay. Archie. Came to town after grub tools and so forth on Wednesday, 26th. And we got 4 trout from 11 to 13 inches in the creek in the evening. And Saturday, Bill and I came to town in the morning. Archie stayed in camp. And Bill and I went back to camp on Sunday evening. And Archie came home in the evening on Saturday because he was getting ready to go back to school. Archie and I packed up to camp in the a.m. and went on trail in the p.m. And we worked on the trail in, well, till September 9th, we had a pretty good snow, and it was cool. And Bill went down the trail. Go to the circus. It's light. He never saw a circus, so he laid off to go to the circus. It's light. He saw a bunch of bighorn sheep in the morning of the day. Saturday, 9:12:25, Archie's last day at school. It's Monday. Archie was about, he was 14, 15, 16 years old.
Then he was going back to high school, right?
Yeah, high school. And we packed up the camp in the forenoon, Bill and I. No, I came alone. Bill was still at Slider at the circus. And he got back at noon on Tuesday. And we went after powder to pack horses on Friday. And it finished the upper part of the trail. That's where it cleared over the top at about 14,000 feet. And packed the outfit down to below the Box Canyon. And cached the same and came to town. And we went duck hunting with Louise on Sunday. We got 8 ducks. Pretty good. And on Monday, Bill
and I... What was the limit on ducks then?
I don't know. I got 8 anyhow. Bill and I packed up the balance of our camp outfit and fixed up camp. We packed some in from the horses from home. And we was around camp on Wednesday. I went out and killed a snowshoe rabbit, and it snowed 8 inches. So we came to town on Thursday and went duck hunting on in the afternoon. Bill got 2 teal and I got a jackrabbit. Joseph and I drove out to the ranch in the afternoon. Met Deweese for Sunday. And Wednesday, Bill and I came up to camp, packed powder up, so forth. Took the horses back to the ranger station and had a little pasture fence coming up for the horses. And Saturday we came home. And on Sunday we picked pin nuts in the Bolamingo Hills. On Monday, we didn't get anything. And we worked on the trail, so, well, Thursday, Shorty, shooting stumps, cleaning out dead trees and so forth, the dynamite. And I met Bill coming towards camp as I was pulling out. He had stayed all night at Harry Dickens. And on Saturday, I went home and started to build a trailer for the fours, and finished the trailer on Sunday. And on Monday, Joseph and I went to Canyon and got a load of fruit. And on Saturday, Archie and I worked on the trail, and we also worked on Sunday. We came home in the evening. And we worked on the trail from October 27th to the 31st, which is the 1st of November. And it snowed 10 inches on the 2nd of November. And we finished the trail down to the rock slide on Tuesday the 11th and came down to Falkenburg Cabin in the evening. It's a cabin that Falkenburg had built, and we spent the night there. And on the 11th of November, we packed the camp equipment out to Alvarado Ranger Station and came home in the evening. Spent the rest of the winter carpeting, doing a little riding and so forth. And I continued to work on the forest trail during the summers of 1926 and 27. We started out in the spring of 27. 1926.
Okay.
To build the Rainbow Trail, which is a trail that runs from near Salida to Music Pass, and just parallels the range just on the forest land. And it's a horse and footpath, of course. And we worked the crew on that of all from 4 to as much as 8 men at times. And we hired them and worked them in pairs, 2 men that could get along together and like the same grub. And there's no such a thing then as sleeping bag. You hadn't been heard of. So the two pair would work together and eat together and sleep together. And it, well, it made things more harmonious around the camp to work them in that way. So we'd move our camp, oh, maybe 2 miles beyond the end of the trail where it had been completed, and then work back to where we'd connect up with the trail and then work ahead of the whole couple of miles and then move our camp again. And that way we completed the Rainbow Trail during the years of 1926 and 1927. In the spring, before time to go to work, why, Roy Truman at the time was our ranger, and he would say, "Well, get things ready, Arts, your men and your tools and everything." And that is generally before you could get into the mountains, really, because it took some time to get everything together. Anyhow, I'd get my crew from 2 to sometime as much as 8 men. Well, we'd go up and camp on some creek, a good camping place where there's water and generally some trout if we could find that kind of a stream, of course. Well, then I'd take one of my men, a guy that I liked pretty well, a buddy of mine, and we'd start out ahead and survey our routes. Well, I was given on the map the limits of the deeded land and the boundaries of the forest and instructions from the ranger who really was supposed to do the laying out, but for me to do the work of laying out. Well, we'd go ahead and we'd survey ahead a route, and it was allowed a maximum of 15% grade going across a draw or over a hump. Well, me and my buddy, we'd survey ahead, and then the men would come behind us. And the tools needed were an axe, saw for smoking out the timber, dynamite for blowing out stumps and rocks, and a pick and a bar. And the most universal tool, the main tool we couldn't get along without, was a grubbing hole, or we called them a hoe daddy. But it's just a one-bladed grubbing hoe. And with them, we did the most of the work, just hoeing it out and grabbing the trail about, 60 to 20 inches wide and level, and keeping within our 15% grade, and swamping out the timber so that when you stand in the middle of the trail, you couldn't reach a tree on each side.
Oh.
Something like 6 feet in the clear, see?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What is
a
grubbing hoe?
Well, it's a matter. I think is a correct name for him. It's just a rough hoe with a short handle, about a handle like the length of a pick, you know. And you just grub out and pull the dirt out and make your trail that.
Now, a question that occurs to me, how long after you had done the essential work or the first work on a trail, How many years would it take of use for that trail to really be in good shape?
Well, it was in perfect shape when we got through with it.
Oh,
we not only leveled it out and smoothed it, and our traveling back and forth to work would pack it down enough.
Oh. Mm-hmm.
And we put in water bars to keep the water from running down the trail and washing and eroding, which consists of maybe a bunch of rocks, and many times just a little log laid across the trail and buried diagonally to run the water out of the trail so it wouldn't wash. And the trail would that way would last for many years without being washed or hurt at all. Of course, eventually you'd have to go back and swamp out the brush until it didn't go up, and to keep a clearance in the trail, you know. But it was laid out why they'd last for many years without any attention at all. Although every spring there was a crew went out to just go over the trail and roll rocks out and one thing or another. And another thing we did while we built this trail, it's parallel, there's a rainbow trail that paralleled the range, was work on the trails running up to all of our lakes. We run trails up to there, we'd have a camp, and then go on to the main trail, and then fix the trail up to the lakes at the same time. Mm-hmm. And we worked with that for, well, I worked 2 years on the rainbow trail after we did our lake trail work to start out with.
Oh. Mm-hmm. You made the trails up to the lakes before you made the
rainbow trail. There was a trail to the lakes before the rainbow trail was thought of.
Oh, well, I thought it was the other way around, but then that's how confused I am.
No, every trail, a lake, there's a good trail in there, but you'd probably, from one lake to another, you'd have to come clear down to the valley for miles and then go up to get to another trail that probably went over a mile or so apart.
I see.
But after the rainbow trail was made, well, you could just follow along it and go up to every lake, and you come with a trail leading up to them.
Well, you're describing how carefully you laid out and made the Rainbow Trail. I think evidences the fact that it has existed for a number of years without much repair work. Now, I understand the Forest Service in the last 2 years has decided to pay a little attention to the Rainbow Trail again and do some work. However, the man that takes the big trail ride on the Salida, they start at Salida and go clear across the Rainbow Trail each August. He said that the beginning from Hayden Pass, is that where it starts?
Well, no, it went beyond there.
Oh.
Really, but the trail that runs clear to Salida.
Mm-hmm. Well, anyhow, the beginning of the trail is the worst part, up until about Lake Creek.
Yeah.
And then it becomes like a boulevard, I guess, or at least better.
Well, it's not hard to keep in repair if they just do a little swamping every year to cut out the aspen. You see, an aspen will go up 3 or 4 feet, and in a couple of years, why, they really bother.
Mm-hmm.
So they keep the brush swamped out, and maybe do a little hodag work once in a while, put in a water bar, and they're not very hard to maintain. But the trails running to the lakes, owing to the fact that it's quite a grade, and they need considerable work every year to keep them safe, because something will happen in here, the water comes down the trail and it becomes the distance of the trail, you know.
Right.
And they take considerable work every year. But the Rainbow Trail isn't or shouldn't be hard to keep up.
Mm-hmm. Here about 2 or 2.5 years ago, we heard all sorts of good rumors that the Forest Service was thinking of making the Rainbow Trail into a road. Across. What would be your attitude toward that?
It would be quite a project, I'll tell you. But it would be possible, all right. And if they'd save some of the money we're spending in Vietnam and other useless projects and getting to the moon and, you know, a lot of silly things, well, they could have a trail along there just fine. It wouldn't cost us the same.
But you wouldn't be opposed to motor vehicles being up there then?
Oh, no. They've got to restrict traveling up and down the hills where there isn't a maintained trail or road on account of erosion. You've got to do that. But it'd be a wonderful thing to have a road paralleling the range just about where the Rainbow Trail is now. There'd be campsites along there for thousands of people could camp and have a good time and enjoy the forest.
Thank you.
Wonderful thing.
I think it's refreshing to hear someone as young as you, you know, make these statements that means there's plenty of room in the world for all of us, because so many people are kind of have the attitude that everybody else should stay home and we should enjoy all this nature all by ourselves.
Well, it's all right. It's a wonderful thing, but I'll tell you, there's a lot of people that don't deserve to.
Well,
we fixed up lots of nice campground, built the tables and everything all along that range. Eldorado is one example of it. And people go in there, they're just desecrated, they'll leave the place dirty and trash and scattered around. They don't deserve to get out of town at all. But I think that if we put some of our money and effort into educating our children to know and love nature and our teach it right, I think we'd get away with a whole lot of that.
I think you're absolutely right. Education is our only answer on things like this, because you can't have enough police power ever to police everybody that's off the city streets.
No, you can't do it. No, you've got to educate them to it. And it's the easiest thing in the world, I think, for the average child to make a lover of nature out of it. When you've done that, why, you've got it solved, absolutely.
Thank you. I think that's a real good... Okay, A.D., now I'd like for you to tell me just a little bit about the animals that you became acquainted with while you were working on the trail.
Well, of course, we got to see quite a few of them that they didn't really get to be acquainted with, like the deer and an elk now and then, the bighorn sheep, and occasionally a coyote or a bobcat. But there's one animal, it's surprising how soon you can tame them and they'll get to where they don't fear you, is the beaver. I've had them in a beaver dam, so I faced for, well, season after season. They'd come out and sit on the bank within a few feet of me while I was fishing. It didn't fear me at all. And another thing I found is you can take a beaver and catch him, even a mature beaver, and within a week he'll just become a perfect pet. They never think of biting you at all, and they just tame awful quick.
They don't even hit you with the tail.
No,
right?
they're real nice pets. And other animals, of course, we got to see was the mountain groundhog, or we call them whistling pigs, that lived at Timberline. There's an animal that weighed probably, 20-25 pounds. And they harvested...
Mm-hmm.
Huh? Mm-hmm. No. Well, yeah, the real name was marmot, of course. But they would harvest their hay, make hay, and store it away for the winter feed. But they depended a whole lot on robbing another little animal called a coney, or little chief hare, the Indians called him. And they would lay up all just a big stack of hay. And the marmots, they depended on them a whole lot by robbing them in the winter to get their feed.
Where'd they store this hay?
Well, they just store it under a ledge of rock or an overhanging rock or somewhere. Just pile it up, you see.
Mm-hmm.
Or when the snow fell, why, it wouldn't bury it in the snow. They could get under this rock and get it, you see. And these little chief hares, they were tame. You could sit down, they'd come up, and they'd sit up and look you right in the face. They just, well, you might say, so wild that they were tame. They didn't know fear at all.
Mm-hmm.
They're really interesting little animals. And then, of course, we had pack rats and chipmunks. The chipmunks would get to be a menace. I used to tame them when I first went up there. Three or four of them would come and sit on my shoulder and eat out of my hand. But they got to be such a nuisance that I just eventually just tamed one. And that's enough to bother this, because if he got hungry, he'd come in the house, he'd take something off your plate. Or if I was working out on the bench or something, he'd get up on my shoulder and bite my ear if I didn't get something to feed to him. He did, actually, just scratching and biting my ear, just nibbled like a pup would something, no tame like that. And then another thing was the Canada jays, I guess, is what the right name is. We call them campbirds. And most people call them camp robbers. Well, they get to be so darn tame that they're a nuisance. They'll generally just two of them in camp. They raise one young, and generally in February they're hatched, so that when spring comes, why, they don't have nothing about them at all. And this young one will come in often at camp and try to tame him quick, but they'll chase him away. They won't let him stay at all, just chase him away. But they'll light on your head or shoulder or come in the house and get something to eat and just get to be a perfect nuisance, really. And they're camp birds, we call them, or Canada jays, as we called them, Pete and Repeat, because you couldn't tell the male from the female at all, so one of them was Pete and the other would be Repeat.
Yeah.
And You see, I mentioned the chipmunks, didn't you?
Mm-hmm.
Well, there's, of course, some other little animals, porcupines and one thing and another, and pack rats, of course. We tried to get rid of them when we could because they just made such a mess, you know, and dirtying everything up. But that just about is the limit of the animals you see up there in the summertime.
Now, you mentioned bighorn sheep, I think, at one time. You didn't see them too often, though.
Oh,
right?
No. We just happened to be glassing. There's always up about timberline. And there's just an occasion where you get to see them.
Mm-hmm.
Every once in a while, you get to see some. But not very often.
And elk really were rather rare in that time, weren't they?
Oh, yes, they were. They were just in certain areas. Over in the Sand Creek country, we see some occasionally, but deer were quite common, you know, and see them pretty regularly.
Okay, now, another question that occurred to me is, how long did you usually work on the trails? How many months during the year?
Well, we'd go up about the 1st of June, middle of May to the 1st of June, when the snow and started to get out of the hills, and we'd stay up there occasionally until 1st of October, till the snow would run us out. July, August, about maybe 4 months.
4 months.
Three and a half to 4 months at the end.
And I think you mentioned then you usually did carpentry work or something during the winter months, right?
Oh, yes. Yes, my life was spent as a builder, of course. And I built several ranger stations. I built the Alvarado Station, which is now here at is a high school or a grade school?
Well, it's between them. It's the band room for both.
Well, I built that, and I built at La Vida and several places. I built ranger stations while I was
working. You mentioned something way back in the interview about building a trailer for the Forest Service. What type trailer?
Oh, that is one for my own use.
Oh.
I just used it as my car to transport stuff around, you know.
And you mentioned that you had pack animals, but any time that you could use motor vehicles, you truck things in, right?
Well, in moving camp, we often hired some rancher, dickman to somebody, either with a two-wheel cart or with horses to move camp for us. And a lot of the packing we'd end with some of my own horses, right? Well, I mentioned then old Elijah and Queen,
mm-hmm.
and packing stuff into camp and the like of that. But when we'd move camp to building the Rainbow Trail, why, we'd move probably 4 miles and we'd hire somebody to move our equipment that far.
Approximately how many miles of trail did you, could you do in a day? Yeah, we're on.
You are?
We're on, right.
Well, on May 26, 1927, with 5 men, we completed 225 yards of trail and used 7 shots, 15-6 of dynamite blown out of rocks. And on the 27th, we built 240 yards of trail. Of course, it all depended on the going, how much rock there was and everything. It was also you could use your hodak, so I would go right along. Like, well, on May 29th, we finished 465 yards of trail with 4 men, working 8 hours. And we caught 13 trout in the evening after work, too. And on Monday, May 30th, we completed 159 yards of trail. And on Tuesday, 210. So it varied, of course, according to the going. You see, 165, 294, and different amounts we made according to what we had to do to get the trail through, whether we had to swamp it or use dynamite or could do it all with hodags. Now, what else you think about?
I'd like to know just how you used dynamite and if you had to have any special precautions.
Yes, we had to have some special precautions. And I remember one incident. I was a powder man always. I wouldn't trust it to the other men. But I'd put what I call a paster on a rock. That is, we want to split a big rock and not drill a hole in. So we just lay the powder on the rock and cover it with mud. and then put a cap and a fuse in there and light it, and it would split the rock, just split it. Well, I did that once, and I was walking away. I had about 5 minute fuse, and plenty of time to get to a tree I had in mind, and I stuck a cigarette in my face and lit it and started to smoke, and I was about not over 40 feet when that shot went off. It was what we call a runner. You find them occasionally in a fuse, instead of burning at its normal rate of speed, well, it'll just shoot right through. Some imperfection in the fuse. Mm-hmm. And this thing went off, and I always swore that rocks hit both of my ears. And by the time I got to my tree, I got there, but the rocks were all down the time I got there.
Now, what'd you call that, a paster?
Yeah, a paste. You just you would take the stick out of the powder out of the stick and paste it on the rock and then cover it with mud and then shoot it, and that would bust the rock, break it so it can move, see. Or we wanted to get them down small enough so we could roll them out of the trail. Mm-hmm. But this time I'd got a runner fuse. This is very rare. I never knew but one other in my life, and I've burned thousands of feet of it. There's something wrong in the fuse, and it just goes through quick instead of burning slow.
Well, now usually you use your dynamite to get rid of stumps, though, right?
Well, we would. We blew out a tree if it was right in the survey line. But we'd try to avoid them as much as possible because it made a lot of extra work. We'd blow a tree out of dynamite, you know. But occasionally, if you couldn't get away from it, why, we'd just drill in the tree. Wouldn't cut the tree down, just drill in and get the powder down, maybe a little below ground level, just a little, and that would blow the stump out and the tree too. But we didn't use much of it blowing out trees or stumps. We'd go around then. But rocks, we had to do a lot of rock shooting. Because going to certain rate grades, well, ever so often you hit a rock, probably be just a big rock you couldn't move. And you'd run into solid formation too, where maybe for quite a distance you'd have to just burn it out with powder to get a trail around a certain place, but you'd have to go into a solid formation. So we used lots of powder, just lots of it.
Now, when you refer to powder, are you talking about what I know as a stick of dynamite,
yeah,
or loose powder?
40% dynamite, yeah.
40%.
There's 40% nitroglycerin, and their base is sawdust, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Just right for dynamite.
And you would, some of these you would split and take the powder out, right?
Oh, yeah, to put a paster on. Why, we just take it out of the paper and cover it with mud, and that would break the rock. If you didn't cover it with mud, it wouldn't do much good, but if you just put a little something there for resistance, and then really break the rock.
Oh, good. I'm glad you explained that. Now, A.D.'s going to tell us about one of the most colorful characters he's ever known.
Well, I believe that, of course, I mentioned Bill Falkenberg was, he was the wonder. I don't know, I loved him. He's a good man. We were friends, and I just liked everything about him. But another guy that was quite a character and interesting and a good guy, we call him Cap Purdy. I don't remember his name, but he was a bachelor. And he had a cabin over in the edge of the hills. And he worked with me for several years. He's a good worker, a good camp man, and a good buddy to be around. But every year, he would quit, would lay off. We'd drawn pretty good wages, but he'd lay off a week to pick huckleberries. He was a bachelor, of course, so he'd spend a week picking huckleberries, because he just had to have his huckleberries. And he was quite a character, too. And he, Cap, one thing I remember about him, he was deadly afraid of lightning. Just crazy. Lightning, he wouldn't get under a tree, of course. He's smart there. But if we're in camp, he'd go and get in my tent. I carried a feather bed along with me, feather tick. And a thunderstorm come up, and I'd find Cap right in the middle of my bed. He'd lay some newspapers on so it wouldn't get dirty, and sitting right there. And one of the funniest things happened once. We come up with a thunderstorm, and all the lightning was just popping around. And I never feared it. I always figured, well, if you got hit, you hit, that's it, you know. It never worried me. I just like to just get in a sheltered place and just watch the lightning strike right close to me. But this time, this storm was a raging, just lightning right close, and the thunder, you could just hear it hiss before you heard the sound of it. and I looked for camp, so I went and pulled back the flap of my tent, and there he was, my feather bed, and just about then, it hit a big pine, just about 100 feet from us, and blowed stuff all over camp. Just splintered that tree, blowed wood all over camp. So I didn't laugh so much at camp.
You thought maybe you joined it in the middle of that feather bed. Yeah. I start this adventure from life, Mr. Hess.
What is that recording?
Sure.
Well, when I was 13 years old, I had a stepmother, of course, and a bunch of half-brothers and sisters. My mother died when I was about 4, and I had a sister 2 years younger than I. And my stepmother was a good woman. She treated me all right, but I was kind of, you know, the ugly duckling. I wasn't really one of the buds, because I had 4 half-brothers and sisters. So finally I made up my mind to get out of there. I was grown. And Dad went to Chicago on business, and I took out that evening on Halloween. I was 13 in July, and it was Halloween party that I took out. Well, I got on, rode the train, blind baggies and block cars, rode the rods and every other way, and finally got back to where we had lived before at Monmouth Highway. And the farmer there that I knew, I went out and saw him and hired out to shuck corn with him. Well, he gave me a job. I knew him quite well when I was a kid, just a year or two before he left there. Well, eventually I wrote Dad where I was at. And eventually he sent Sam money to buy me a ticket and take me to Mount Auburn and put me on the train and send me home. So, all right, eventually he was going to Mount Auburn after some lumber. And I got on the wagon with him, riding on the running gears, and I got past the house. And I said, wait, I got to get my clothes. I'd put what few clothes I had in the bundle, so he stopped, and I went back. And I went in the front door of the house, and I got my clothes. But I come out the back door, and I hit the timber. And I figured later that I went 30 miles that day, just keep to the timber like a coyote coming road, and I'd see nobody there, and I'd get across it into the brush again. And at evening, I come up to a place, I forget the name of the people now, it's a long time ago, but long about supper time, and asked for a job of shucking corn, and I got it. And then I stayed a whole year or so more before I ever did go home, working here and there.
You worked on the farm?
Yeah, I worked on the farm, one thing and another. Yeah.
And at 13, did other people consider you grown up or just you?
Just me. I thought I was grown up. Well, I was. I must have weighed, I believe I weighed 150 pounds then. Pretty good sized kid. Mm-hmm. And I got along all right. I made it all right.
How much schooling had you had? I presume you didn't have any after 13.
Well, our education was graded by the first, second, third, and fourth, and advanced fourth readers, see?
Oh. Uh-huh.
I was in the fourth reader.
The fourth reader,
yeah.
Okay.
And that was it.
Were you a good student?
I was pretty good at arithmetic and spelling. I was a wow at spelling. And, I guess pretty near average in most things. But I didn't try to not let my education stop there. I loved to read, study. Anything your hobby ever got, I studied, find out something about it.
You run away?
Huh?
Oh, that's
right. Madam Ma. And another thing, when my kids started to college, they discarded their books, and I sort of went through them, you know. I got a little out of it, so that...
You were self-taught.
Yeah. I think that I've learned a little every year I've lived, a little something, and I believe that when a man stops trying to improve himself a little or learn a little, maybe every day, and from Printer, anybody you meet, you can learn something. Well, if you stop that, why, you just as well die. You're not there anymore.
I'm glad you brought all this out, because I think you're one of the best educated people I've ever known. Now, we're going to go back a minute here. How about after you were 15, you went home, you said, briefly.
Yeah.
Then what did you do?
Well, at 16, I went to the Black Hills, South Dakota.
That sounds
and,
good.
I worked for a cattleman, squaw man, Henry Lang, his name was, pretty good-sized cattleman, as a rider and wrangler in the summertime.
for 3 years, and then I was in the timber in the woods all working the sawmill and trapping and or just anything to earn a buck during the winters. But the 3 year summers I worked for Lang, who, as I said, was a squaw man. He married this, well, she was a half-blood Indian woman, and her name was Anna Arori. And she had a sister, Emma. She's the one I saw her get stuck on. But I say she wanted a man, full-grown man, so I didn't get Emma. But that's where I got my Indian experience during them years. Mm-hmm. Well, then at 19, I went to Oklahoma, and Joe saw me, and that's it.
That was it. She decided that's the one for me. And it took you how many years to talk her into it?
About 3 years.
What were you doing? Were you farming at that time?
I'd done a little farming and a little carpentry building. Long, but
mostly you were girling, huh?
Well, not much. Stuck on her cousin. There was her and her father and his twin brother.
Now stick to the truth here, Father.
They lived right across the road from one another, see? And her folks had 9 children.
And who's this now, Josie's folks?
Her folks, 9. And Henry, that's her father's twin brother, just across the road, so rocked at one house the other. Mm-hmm. He had 11, so there was 20 kids just across the road. Well, I got stuck on Ann. She was about my age, I guess. Nice little gal, a little tall gal, good looking gal. Well, I'd rented some land from her dad and planted some cotton and one thing another and was living in a tent down in the holler in the canyon. But I'd go down to Garrett's darn near every evening, you know, me and Ann and had another girl named Minnie. But, I loved her a lot, too, but her dad told me that she's too young. She was only a year or two younger than me. Anyhow, I'd go down to see Ann, and we'd be playing cards, razzle-dazzle or something. Here'd come Joe down, you know.
Oh, listen. I'm going to add something to this.
And she'd get in the game, you know. Well, then when I'd go home, I'd had my horse and buggy out the road, you know, tied up. And Josie'd go home at the same time, and of course, and she'd go on across. And finally, I damn went clear across the road with her one evening and got on her porch, and I stayed there quite a while. And finally, I don't know, something happened, and I started to go to her house, and that was it.
The horse probably became trained and stopped at the wrong house or something.
See,
right?
That reminds me one time after Joe's had me hooked pretty well. We went to a dance, way off, about 6 miles of this darn dance, you know. And we was coming home and in the top buggy, you know, and we had a lantern under the lap robe in the wintertime. God, this is snug and nice, you know. And I don't know what was happening. Anyhow, first thing.
Now listen, don't leave the thing like that.
The first thing I know, the horse stopped, see? Well, it went into a hitch rack in front of a house where a couple other girls lived, you see. Well, we scrapped all the way home. She claimed that horse had been stopping there all the time.
Uh-huh, that's one way to get caught.
Well, I had been there a time or two, but the darn horse was just tired, that's all.
That's all.
He wanted to be tied up.
Then you did get buried in Oklahoma.
Yeah, finally after about 3 years, she
said yes.
She popped the question.
Uh-huh.
I'd wait for her to ask me.
And then what prompted you to come to Colorado?
Homestead land.
How'd you homestead?
Huh?
How did you homestead? What was the procedure?
Well, I filed on 160, and then I put in an application for an enlarged homestead, got another 160. Well, then the section law was passed, and I got another half a section.
Hmm.
I had approval from that, and boy, she ranched for about, my gosh, 30 years, I guess.
And she was a rancher.
Yeah, I got out in the building, and kids are going to school, you know, and she run the ranch.
I like the farm. Mm-hmm.
She'd keep some girl. We raised a couple of gals. Well, don't need to mention the name. They live around the country here, yeah, but they was our girls. We got a poor family, you know. And seeing a girl and a hired man run the ranch, well, I built and kept buying a little land till when we sold out, we had 4,000 acres.
What school did your boys go to? What country school?
They went to Froze Creek School.
Froze Creek?
Froze Creek.
Well, and then they went to
high school here in town?
Right down here in Westwood.
High school? Did he go to grade school?
Is that thing
on?
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, when you walked in and built the ranger station, they went to the West Cliff School.
Yeah, they went to the grade school here, too, but their first school was the Froze Creek.
Froze Creek,
school,
then yeah.
And then they went to...
1 year at Silverfoot.
To Colorado College, and they both got their master's at Colorado College. Well, then Archie went to Cornell University and got his PhD. Mm-hmm. And the kids, they got their education and stuff, but all we'd done for them was their washing them. Oh, $1.02 now and then. They made their way and done it.
They worked their way through school.
Yes. Archie was teaching, and Bud in athletics. He was called him the Iron Man in college, you know. He'd go from one event into another, and he'd go to meets, and he'd make over half the points for the whole darn bunch.
I didn't know this. I'm glad
you half the points of college. We have pictures of him.
And Archie was, after he got his... before he got his master's, after he got his bachelor's degree, he taught. And he made a little extra and helped Bud some, too, you know. He teaches and went on to get his other degrees, you see.
Well, he didn't help Bud pay his way in school.
Oh, he did some, didn't he?
No, he didn't.
Didn't?
Bud worked in his own.
Well, I know,
would
but
you like to come over here, Mrs. Hess, and tell us now about the things that were on the ranch?
No.
Oh, okay, then we'll let Mr. Hess tell it. What
else
did you have? Diversified farming or just ranching?
To start with, why...
What year are we talking about when you first came out?
I know it's about better 50 years ago. I'd have to look it up.
1917.
No, it wasn't that late in law, was it? We was married in 10.
Well, now, wait a minute. Let me see. Archie was 5 when we came out. It was 1960.
This is side 2 of the A.D. Hess story.
And some years we've done very well. Other years we've been paying for the sacks. Mm-hmm. But, of course, I got out, done building, made a little money, and kept buying a little land all the time. And finally we got into cattle. And we run about... 50 cows, and then we'd never sell a calf, but keep those yearlings, you see.
We had 150 when we sold off.
Yeah, we had about 150.
What kind of cattle?
Well, we got into the Shorthorn.
Shorthorn?
Papa, Hereford.
Well, Shorthorn, Hereford. Hereford, Shorthorn.
A Hereford is not a Shorthorn.
God damn it, they were. Mother, we got a Shorthorn bull.
Listen.
Mother,
a cross between Hereford and Shorthorn.
No, a Shorthorn Hereford.
Oh, okay.
They're Shorthorns. God dang it, they're...
Pole Hereford. A Pole Hereford, yeah.
Well, pole, it's no horn. The Shorthorn, he got no horn.
Pole Hereford.
Pole Hereford.
Shorthorn Hereford, that ain't no such a thing.
Well...
I'm going to have Ben Kepler.
I'll have to do
this. Okay, he's not a farmer.
I found that out.
From, working out.
Well, what's the difference? Pole to Shorthorn.
He comes home from San Isabel, where he's working, one weekend, and he come in and tried to chase our cattle all out the gate.
Well, come on over here and tell it.
Come on, all these strange cattle in our place. And I said, there are cattle.
Come on and tell it. Did you get that?
Yes, loud and clear. It was over there.
Did she get...
Why, sure, it'll be on there.
Well, that's the truth. I went after the cows and I tried to run them god dang heifers off the place. There's nothing over there's ours, you know. And they just run and switch their tail and bawl, you know. And they just running them, trying to get rid of the sons of guns. There's our cows.
So what they really had was Angus. No, Shorthorns. I'll believe Mr.
Well,
okay.
Pole Herefords.
Go right ahead. Tell me something besides cattle.
Oh, that's so.
When you talk about cattle and say, look like you do, they'll know you don't know a thing about cattle.
Well,
I didn't know our cattle, but then I know what cattle
but
was.
But you know other cattle, sure. Now, you said potatoes you raised at first. How long did this big potato boom last here in the valley? I've heard people refer to it, but...
No, it was up and down, up and down. We've sold them for 50 cents a hundred, and then it got as high as 2.5 and 3 cents for them.
I see.
It was just almost just sort of a living, that's all. And lots of work, lots of work. We raised from 75 to 100 ton every year. And some years we'd make some money, I'd buy a little land, Next year, why, we just barely paid for sacks.
And you stored the potatoes in potato cellars?
Oh, I had a big cellar that would hold at least 100 tons. And then in the winter, we'd get in there and sort them and sack them. And a lot of them I'd haul off myself. And others, trucks would come, and I'd sell them to trucks. And we made a living out of it, of course. But it just wasn't nothing certain about what you'd get.
And when they were real cheap, did you sometimes sell them to or feed them to your animals?
Well, we fed a lot of them to the pigs.
I had tons of them away from the ship down to the people in the deep south when they were starving down there living on dried walnuts, you know. We donated tons of potatoes to the people in the south, you know.
That's good to know. I knew.
Somebody hauled them free, but we give them the potatoes.
Well, we'd get enough before.
Free and shipped them to the poor people in the south when they're starving.
Did you ever grow lettuce or anything over
yes,
there?
Yes.
Tell us about the lettuce.
Huh?
Can you tell us
about
the lettuce?
Well, we made a little money out of it.
From the mountain place.
Oh. Yeah, we grew that up at Beaver Lodge.
Oh.
And, oh, just wonderful lettuce, but, well, sometimes we'd make a little money at it, and sometimes, well, I'd just about pay for a haul and all, you know. So we quit that.
Don't you have quite a few bugs to fight when you're raising things like lettuce?
No. Deer, mostly, and porcupines, eating the lettuce.
The deer really enjoyed it,
didn't they? They bite out of the top of the head.
Yeah, they'd bite out of this head and bite out of that head, you know. Ruined a lot of it, but we had a lot of it, so didn't mind that too much. But a porcupine would get out in the pasture and do more damage than does deer. He'd just go out and eat a hole of this and a hole of that just all night and just ruin a whole bunch.
We raised peas too.
Yeah, peas.
Down on the lower ranch.
Yeah, and on Beaver Lodge too.
Yes, peas. But on the lower ranch we raised lots of peas down on the lower ranch.
That's the green
more
peas,
than
you know. Pick the green peas. Oh, we done pretty good. The prices then wasn't much, but everything else was cheap, so we got by pretty good. With her running the ranch and me working, right, we made it pretty good.
Well, that sounds like the necessity of today. You can't expect the ranch to support you, especially a small ranch. But, of course, as you pointed out, you had a large one by the time you sold out.
Yeah, pretty good size ranch. It sold, I think, last spring for around $100,000. This level outfit got it. In fact, there's an airstrip on the ranch that cost them more than we got for the whole ranch when we sold it.
Mm-hmm.
We got about $20,000 when we sold it.
All right. Tell me about Beaver Lodge, when you decided to build it and so forth.
Well, I bought it from Mexican, Alfonso Sias was his name, that had homesteaded. And me and a friend of mine, who had quite a family of children, name was Lester. And we got a big idea about having a resort, you know, for tourists and one thing or another. So we bought it in partnership, with $800 for it.
How much land?
160. And then we got about 10 acres more from the forest and we put a ditch into a lake. That don't cost us anything. We just fenced it in because it's part of our project. So we got our water rights for it and all. Anyhow, Lester's wanted to go ahead and all build cabins and this and that. And big stuff, you know, and get a resort or go and buy a horse. And I couldn't see it. I'd been around to talk to some of the other resort owners here. And kind of got the lowdown about what money they was making and this and that, and I decided I didn't want to go into it that heavy. So I sold out to them. And so they started in, and they went across the creek, and a bunch of pines, they're old, beautiful pines, about 10 or 12 inches through, nice house log, tall. And they cut down a flock of them enough to build a couple of cabins, and they never even drug them out of the timber. Didn't do a dang thing with it. So eventually, the old folks, Lester, died in just in a few years after that. And then one of these boys come to me, wanted to borrow some money. We had a little money in the bank. And so I told him no, I didn't want to loan money. I wasn't in the business of loaning money. Well, they kind of got so, are you a friend of us? Ain't we friends? I said, yeah, but we want to be friends. We want to keep being friends. I don't want money. Well, I said, I'll buy a beaver lodge back of you. All right, sell it to me. So I said, all right, what do you want? Well, I said, you want $5,000? I said, you're just crazy as you know what. I said, I'll give you just what you paid me for it, $800. Oh, no, they couldn't do that. I don't know. I says, you make up your mind. I says, I'll make out a deed to the place and put it in the bank. And George Bisley run the bank there at that time. And I says, any time that you want to sell it for that, well, you paid me for it. Well, I go down there and give George the money, he'll give you the deed. So that's the way they got Beaver Lodge back. The same money that we...
You just
got.
Waited them out.
Yeah, I just waited them out. They had to have the money, you see. Mm-hmm. Of course, now I've been offered $25,000 for lending.
Right.
I wouldn't think so. Of course, it ain't mine anymore. We ain't got wind or nothing else, you know. We got everything. We got the kid and all our property. But it's worth quite a bit of money now.
Right.
But it ain't worth a darn to the kids. On account of that, I'll get some gas. On account of the fact that it'll never make them any money, see? You take a piece of property like that that's, well, it's part of the family, mm-hmm. and all you can do is enjoy it and pay taxes on it. Mm-hmm. They'll never make a cent out of it, of course, as far as I'm concerned. And yet they wouldn't think of selling it.
Right. So well, the type work they're both in, though, they do sort of need a retreat.
Well, yeah.
Makes it nice that
I
way.
I know, but then it ain't no money to make propositions.
Well, I realize that. It's just you like, tell me something about the cabin that's in Beaver Lodge. You tell me, let's see, it started, what'd you do, build one room first?
Well, first you built the old cabin.
Okay.
It's just all rough logs and one thing and another. It's a pretty good little cabin. Well, then we built a new cabin next to it and left a space between so that in case you want to tear the old one down, it won't interfere the new one. And we left what we call a dog trot in between them where we hang our coats and wood and one thing and another, you know. And the new cabin has got... Well, it's got a bedroom off of it. You've slept in it, haven't you?
Why, it's my bedroom, yeah. And I don't believe I've been
there.
So
you heard that you helped put in one log, didn't
Certainly.
You?
Certainly.
Yes, sir.
I really helped.
Well, that's pretty nice. We got that fireplace there that's, well, has a month of building it. And it's rock and mineral specimens and fossils. And it's precast blocks and then laid up, you know. You know it.
Yes, I know it. That's
and
why I
you never take the ashes out. They drop down, and once a year you would take the ashes out behind it. And that's right. This fireplace here, you got to take them out every day in a bucket and dump them, you see.
That's really a disadvantage.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But that is it's a nice place up there.
Did you do all the work on the fireplace yourself?
Well, no more. Help me a little.
Oh, thank you.
I was about a month of building that darn fireplace. Mm-hmm. That's a pretty fireplace. So you have precast that you see in blocks of the minerals in them, and by making in forms and laying the minerals in and then pouring the concrete on, that lets them face to see where the minerals. You know how it is.
Yes.
And it's a pretty darn nice job.
It certainly is, and it's real unusual.
Yeah, it is.
An
yeah.
individual.
Yeah, it's pretty well made. And now, it's all lined with fire brick. And
well, nice people where Beaver Lodge is.
Well, I think it's about enough nose, man.
You don't want to tell them.
Well, there's other people that I wouldn't mind going up there. Nice people. Although we've had, very little vandalism. I think about 2 blankets is all we ever had stole up there. Mm-hmm. And it's open the year round, and anybody go up there, we go up sometimes and they're traveling in there having a chicken dinner or something, you know. And in fact, I get about as much pleasure out of her friends or any other nice people enjoying it as much as they do. Of course, it's never locked, and people that know us know that they're welcome, and they use it, well, amongst them many times more than we do, you see. Because there's somebody up there, somebody putting her all the time. And most of them are just, they're very nice about it. They wash the dishes, they leave some wood in the cabin, they take care of it. Clean it up, you know. But last summer I went up there, man, mad as the devil, it was during deer season. And there was a lady, I guess she was a lady, and she had a daughter about, I think she was 15 or 16. And there are men folks who hunt deer, and they were sitting in the living room, as we call it, big room where the fireplace is. And that place was a shambles, just dirt and trash and stuff, litter scattered all over. And them just sitting there with long faces, mad about something, I guess. The dishes dirty in the kitchen. Well, that just made me mad. I just come out and went home, left them. But people would go into a place like that, as nice a place as that is, and then just not clean it up or keep it clean and take care of it or appreciate it. They ain't my kind of people. Don't tell me about it. Most of the people that go up there, they appreciate it. You take, Eddie Jones. They always went up there, him and his mother, married the cook, you know. Mm-hmm. And, of course, anybody used a cabin, but eventually, well, they got taken their trailer up there. And now, Eddie, I'll give him permission. He's got a big, long trailer. And he parks it up there just where he can see the lake. And he's leaving about a year round, and he's kind of the boss of the place, you see. Well, Marie and Bert Cook, that's his mother, why, they wanted to move their trailer over by him, see. But they'd been camping just south of us on the muddy ridge just outside of our fence. Mm-hmm. And he says, nothing to do. He says, you get right out there. And he said, don't go that way across that muddy. You follow the road going across there, too. So Eddie's kind of our watchman up there. He got his trailer parked on there continually, you know. But he wouldn't let his mother and his stepdad come over there. He said, it'll be just a darn trailer camp. He says, this is all that's going to be on here. So he's a darn good guy to have on the plane.
Right.
And Eddie, a lot of them don't like him, but, well, I've always considered him as kind of one of my boys, and he knows it. I've always liked him ever since he was a little kid, you know. And he's a darn good guy to have on the place. He likes me, and I like him.
Now that we haven't told them where it is, except somewhere near the muddy, the fact that you have to go through some of the National Forest before you get there, right?
About a mile. It's a mile within the boundary of the National Forest.
How did this happen? Do you know how this happened? Why do we have it cut up like that? We have private land within the National Forest.
After the National Forest was first established, I was in the Black Hills as a kid at the same time. At the time it was established under Roosevelt, wasn't it?
Cleveland?
Anyhow, they had a rule or a law that any land that within the laid out boundaries of the forest that was more valuable for agriculture than for timber could be homesteaded, see. Well, now they've taken that out of the law. Now you can't do it anymore. But that time you could homestead within the boundaries of the forest. And that's the way this would Alfonso Sayas soil laws for farms, see. So since then, the most vast majority of these tracts, the government has got a hold of them by giving them a place of equal or better value outside of the boundaries of the forest, see? Yep. Well, they've tried it on me for years, offered me this ranch and that ranch, but I wouldn't think.
You're not coming out.
Well, no. And eventually I went to a personnel meeting in the forest, of the Forest Service in Pueblo. And Polk was the supervisor. He brought up the...
Why should that be down?
He...
Tape recorder.
Because we want it.
He brought up the question to buy or trade for beaver lives again. Well, a secretary, and I forget his name now, but he got up and he says, listen. He said, we've been bothering Hess for years about getting this piece of land he's got up there. And he says, Hess, at the present time, he's a forest guard. He's watching the interests of the forest up there, and he's a conservationist. His place is a wildlife sanctuary, and he's a nationalist. He likes it, and he says, I think that the government is better off for him to own it than for us to own it. And I think we ought to leave him alone. Well, they've never bothered me since.
Well, good.
So, That's the way I got the beaver lodge and the reason I kept it.
But our forest boundary, like along the Sangre de Cristo, is real cut up and real jagged, isn't it?
Why, sure. It was laid out in land that was supposedly valuable, more valuable for agriculture than for the forest. Even if it was public land, why, they left that out, see? Mm-hmm. And, of course, now it's all been homesteaded and proved up on. that anything that they thought was more valuable, why they left that outside of the boundary of the forest.
What do you know about the over by San Isabel? Have you worked over there? Mrs. Hess mentioned something about you coming home from San Isabel.
Yeah, I worked over there at at Lake Isabel. It's what is being built, you know. Well, I was a foreman on constructing that. And Lake Isabel was being built.
You mean the lake?
The lake, yeah.
Campgrounds and so forth. That ought to come in real good on tape recorder. Crunch. Know anything else about the forest you'd like to tell us?
Well, I know a lot about the forest, quite a bit that don't need to be told, everybody knows, but the trees and the animals and everything that's up there. And the summer climate, that's a wonderful thing. You know, in the summer when it's hot, sweaty down below, and you cool off and enjoy yourself. And there's no such a thing up there as air pollution at all. You got good clean air to breathe and good spring water, too. So it's a nice place in the summertime.
Mm-hmm. What about diseases that the trees get sometimes? We have never had too much problem, have we?
No, there's not much disease here. We have a mistletoe infestation of some of our pines, which is not serious. It don't hurt the pines much. And then we have the pine beetle, which is controllable. You've got to cut down lots of timber, but I think they control it pretty well. That's the dead doctor, I forget the name of it, but it's a pine beetle.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a certain beetle of the same species, but a different variety for the different conifers. See? This one works on the western yellow pine. I remember him, he's Dendroctonus ponderosa. Just have to remember that. But then there's a different beetle, a different variety, works on the pinions and on the spruce, see. Well, those are the most serious enemies of the forest, is a beetle.
Mm-hmm.
Your mistletoe, it all kind of stunted tree, but it don't really hurt it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And there's no other serious disease that I know of in the forest here. But there has been whole areas been killed off by the beetle.
Yes.
And then they just have to go in, they cut them down and burn them. They don't have to burn them all together, but they burn enough to kill the beetles, which are just under the bark. See, by the time they girdle the tree, just cut the cambium through around the tree or kill the tree. They don't go any deeper than just under the bark.
And you mean when they circle the tree?
Amongst them, if they circle it, it's circled, right? That cuts off the cambium, which is the growing part of the tree.
Oh.
But that kills the trees.
Oh. Mm-hmm.
But they're quite easy to control. That is, takes work, but they just cut them down and pile the brush up over the logs and just burn them enough that it kills the beetles that's just out of the bark, you see.
Mm-hmm.
And in a couple of years, well, they can get ahead of them and stop an infestation. Otherwise, there's not much disease in the trees, I know of.
This is the conclusion of this taping. Added onto this tape is another oral history taping series of A.D. Hess.
Community building of West Cliff, Colorado, December 1966. Subject of the interview was Mr. A.B. Hess of West Cliff. Present were his wife, Mrs. Hess, Mrs. Bly of West Cliff, Russ Farnsworth, and Dr. Richard Radberg of Florence.
Man, I let out of school, and here she comes running. I thought it was some kind of a figurine or something, but it was just a big bowl, you know.
I see.
And it would have been if the road hadn't been graded out. It would have been 2 feet under the surface, and it was upside down, so it never fucking do anything. And this, well, it's just a pipe system.
Would this be used for grinding corn or something?
A mortar, yeah. And I got a pestle made to use it instead of rubbing it like the mud on the tie where they pound it, you know. And I have a pestle that I found over in Mexico, and it's a few miles from there that I couldn't go with it. But they use them just to
pronounce that professor instead of rubber, Susan.
How do you spell puzzle?
P-S-T-L-E, Mom. Thanks, it's going.
Ask Mom, man. Try to spell it.
Oh, no. Puzzle was used by the early Indians or the Mexicans?
Prehistoric people, and some of them, in some places, I presume, and I know, in Mexico, we traveled quite extensively down there. And there's places there where the Mexicans still speak their old tongue. They never were contacted or had anything to do with the Spaniards way back in there. And they still use mortars and metallics and pestles and a whole lot of stone arrows, although it's just carried down to do it just for kind of a little
tourist trap.
No tourists in there. They could get
kind of a celebration, is it?
They use steel arrows mostly because they're so much better, but they still make them, know how to make them, you see, if you use them. And this certain tribe, they come out, I forget, I can tell on the map where it is, but they come out with a herd of birds, just maybe 100 birds, loaded with pineapples. And you can't get into their area even with a jeep. And they come out with these pineapples and squaws and pineapples and all. And they stay in town 3 or 4 days and buy more floss and this and that and back into the home where they live. And they're really pretty. They're averaging right now. And they use all these stone artifacts, as we call them artifacts. But they really use them here today. Of course, they buy pots and pans and stuff back there, yes, and that, but they still make and use these stone artifacts.
Now, of all your arrowheads and these other artifacts that you have accumulated, are a clan member from this particular area?
This, not too many. I really find most of them in Arizona, New Mexico, West Texas, and in old Mexico, in areas of excessive, wind and water erosion, you see, and a little bit of a taste. Now, there's plenty of them, you know, there's just Buddhism or something, and in the east, in Iowa, Missouri, places like that, there's more than a square mile or a square foot in this year, but they're covered in vegetation, see. Mm-hmm. And they find them there when they're farming, just plow them out to find them ourselves. But down in these country, where they're laying right out in the open, where the wind is uncovering, you know.
I see.
So most of them are from those areas.
Okay.
I really have a wonderful collection. I think about the best fire collection.
We like to see that. Now, I would like to get back, if we can, Mr. Hess, to the time when you first came out here in 1916?
Yeah, 16, yeah.
From Oklahoma. Yeah. Now, did you travel with your parents, or what kind of a situation was
it? We had 2 boys. About 4. And we homesteaded. First we filed on 160.
Now, is that right up in this particular area?
It's about 12 miles south of here.
12 miles south of here.
Well, then we petitioned for an enlarged homestead. That's 320. And then the stock raising homestead was passed. Which we took in a section of land, but I don't know, so we had all a section of land all together.
I see.
And then, of course, I was building more ranch out there in the kids for 3 years. And we bought land until I sold out, we had 4,000 acres. And around 100 head of cattle, everything clear. We said, well, let's put out 60. So we just sold out the place. And not long ago, the ranch that I got 20,000 for sold for $100,000.
Yeah, well, it was about the same value then and now as it was then, because money got cheaper, didn't it?
Oh, yes, yeah. But cattle, we sold our cattle, they brought about $40 a pair to come calf.
Is that right?
Yeah, now the calf were really $100.
What kind of cattle were you raising?
We had got into a shorter one like this. So.
Is that brought up from Texas originally?
No, I don't guess where the shorthorn came from. But they were darn good cattle.
Of course, for a while, it was dumb enough that we milked cows for 2 or 3 years. Oh, God, I just got it. Not even my dad can sympathize with that kind of disease to have
something. I did a lot of force work.
Up in the day?
Yeah.
Oh, yes, I was bringing some roads to the park, the ranger station for. You mean these up in the higher mountain areas?
Yeah, built trails. I built a railroad trail for maybe 30 miles of it. And trails to all the lakes here in my area.
Oh,
and built the ranger stations and one thing another. I'd start out in the spring and take about 10 or 12 men. And we'd camp and work both ways, and then we'd have somebody move us on ahead of where to work, you know. And I really enjoyed that work.
And you say you constructed part of the railroad.
Rainbow Trail.
That's a
trail just parallel to which is just walking the timber just on the federal land, you see,
Now that runs all the way down to Slida, doesn't it?
Yeah.
And how far down does it go?
No,
to
the
sand dunes. That's where it goes,
doesn't it? No, the sand dunes on the other side. And it does really stop, that is the regular trail, on the Matterhorn Trail from across the Matterhorn. Of course, there's other trails connecting to those out, but that the main trail, I guess, ran and stopped.
About when was that started, or when were you working on that?
Well, 16. I think I went right to work. We found my something in the summer. I'd have to look up the diary to be definite about it.
He has a complete diary, he said.
Oh, wonderful.
I have a diary that's 50. Well, it started in 1909 every day.
You don't see that as much.
So 57 years then.
So many people used to keep diaries, and I can remember some of my aunts and uncles did, but you don't see that very often.
I started when I was a kid, somebody read it, and I quit.
You tell them everything,
yeah? I told them, I was mad, and I told them things I should have my mother read.
No, we won't do it. Archie and Brett, they're fighting about it, so they get it now. And I tried to get them to start a diary, really, but no. Art's a PhD, and Bud's a math. But they won't pay a few days and then you just go.
Where are they?
Arts is in Greeley. And Bud is in Albuquerque. He's a federal wildlife biologist.
I see.
And Archie is in public health. He's a pretty big man. His laboratory's there, but he's in Greeley.
No, this is the one in Albuquerque.
No.
Archie's the one in Greeley.
Right.
That's my home.
Oh, is it? Well, you don't know me. You don't know me.
But it happened a couple of
years before the Labor Day smell.
But now,
A.D., I know one time you told me about something that you'd constructed on the ranch that goes along with this weather thing that I always thought was real nice, one of the big barrels so that you could get in it if you were waiting for the mailman or something.
No, that was a tee of a great big stack. It was an old smelter, and on this stack was about 4 feet. It was a tee, you know. So I just tinned up the back and the front and put a door in it, and you could put in over on the passage. 2 or 3 people get in there to store me. They still are. I'm out there.
Oh, do you?
Not where we live now, but out of Silverfield.
Oh, I know.
I've got to pull it back, you know. I don't know.
Thanks.
We'll get a picture of that sometime,
yeah.
If you don't mind.
Oh, he's telling
me. And I had a little mailbox. He's still on top of it for letters, you see.
Mm-hmm.
And then the other one. In a storm, we get in there. Do you remember any particularly cold time? Well, we've had 40 years several times, but when you're young and full of blood and all that, you don't pay much attention to them now. But have my nose, of course, I'd freeze to death. But we did the thing at all. We get down to 30, and at times you just avoid them all.
It doesn't seem like it gets down there like it used to.
Well, we haven't had bad winters
the last few years. Well, I can tell that's one thing I keep track of in the diary is the weather. And the well, mostly just whether it's favorable or pleasant, unless it's real, you know, lower the temperature, you see. But the diary tells the weather, but I have an idea if I was writing it now, at my age, the weather would be put down a little different. It affects me more. It would mean a little more, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
You should tell him about your melon? No, that's wrong. I always say it wrong. It's not literal, thank you. Yes, that's
right. Well, yeah, I've got a, well, for a fireplace in the
Lord. So the mining, of course, the time you got here was pretty well closed up here, too, wasn't it?
Oh, they were quite a bit. But from my collection, there's things, everything else we got was every piece is classified. Mostly by fuel mines and anything that might be classified for this government classification. That collection is worth quite a bit of money on account of the fact that the way it's set up and classified catalogs. And every piece where it's from and all that sort of stuff.
I thought they have that put on
swap.
I can give explanations right along. Maybe one day.
This would be very good.
Well, one thing that might be pretty nice, that would be, might be if I could get my artifacts together, an identification of artifacts, you see. There's lots of people out there who live in there, Jordan and one area, and find it, but I found some wonderful pieces later on rock. Somebody's found later down there, didn't know what to go to, see. And that's one thing that. Anything, any of my hobbies, not to have any of them here. But I study them and know something about them, see? It adds interest and everything to it, and then by marking and cataloging, you've got something that's working or something used to science.
That's right, yeah. After you get through with it, while somebody else can put it to real good use as a research project.
Just like the thousands of fragments that I've prepared, everyone is marked and cataloged. Of course, I don't mean that there's a catalog for every piece, but from a certain area, well, there may be hundreds, you see.
Mm-hmm.
But you see, you put them into the area where they are.
That's wonderful.
And an archaeologist can take them and get a lot of good out of them because they're all marked with the problem. And they can take a piece of marrow and some material in the work, you see. I think it's done a lot. They can place them to a different area, you see, because different areas and different tribes, they made here are different stuff. See, of course, I never kept track of that because that gets pretty darn deep in this study and all the particular tribes and everything. But they are marked as to where they were found. We never dug. I don't believe it's against the law, you know, on the land, but I never dug anything. I figured for a man very good, he told me look for. I've got one, I've got a turquoise pendant, but large. The only thing I ever got out of the grave, and they're down in New Mexico when somebody took this guy's bones out. An Indian grave is not deep there. Oh, 2.5 feet or something like that. He was buried. And then dug this grave, and then there was pot sherage and one thing another. So I was throwing his bones back in there, kind of arranged them, the leg bones, and head up here, and things like that. So he'd be coming up. Looked in there and saw this pendant. I said, buddy, out of there, man.
Sorry.
$25 for 50 cents. So, We pulled out and went up into Ed's old home. Why? Good, somebody, a chance of a lifetime. So that's when I got up there and I drove back down. And went in the fast places. You hear it? Yeah. I think we'll pull out today. Look around a little more. So I saw that it was still in the case over there. There's a guy had me stuck on a lid of a shoebox, just had it stuck on. I said, I'd kind of like to deal for that funny area you got over in my house. You got much money. I'll dig with you a little on. What is this? Starts digging. Well, I got to dig it down to $15. This mall just gives me the devil. I knew it was wrong.
This is the conclusion of this oral taping.